Hi, Mickey.
Hey, Bob, how are you?
Okay, how are you?
I am okay. It's raining. Spirits in Westwood are depressed.
Over the rain or something else?
Over the basketball game.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry to hear about that.
Not that I watched it, but I'm still...
Me either. But it's a sad week for UCLA. I'm looking ahead to the Masters and hoping Phil Mickelson will win personally. That's where my sports consciousness is.
Okay, well, that's because you're part of the golf-playing elite.
Wait a second. I've played almost all my golf at municipal courses, Mickey, which is, and they are one of the great social mixers, one of the great social mixing institutions in America.
Okay.
You would love them. There's a lot of social equality there.
Cool.
Now, Mickey, the last thing I would ever do is accuse you of being literally obsessed with any issue, but I just looked at your blog, and you seem to be literally obsessed with the issue of immigration.
Well, this is the crunch week. I mean, this is the time to figure out what you want to do, so.
Yeah, no.
You think about it now,
it's a healthy obsession.
Yeah, okay. I'm glad you agree.
But I have a question.
Yeah?
On this, there's a question that has emerged only recently, I think, and the first time I saw it clearly emerge was on Blogging Heads TV in a dialogue between Byron York and David Korn. And it is it really so clear that immigration is a bigger problem for Republicans than Democrats? That was kind of implicitly assumed for a while. Do you think it's the case?
No, of course not. I think the Democratic Party is split, too. If Senator Byron Dorgan has come out against the semi-amnesty proposed by McCain and Kennedy on the grounds that it lowers wages for workers, and since Democrats are supposed to be the traditional party of workers and unions, they have a lot to lose if a flood of low-wage workers is let into the country.
Well, both parties are split, but given the fact that it's a two-party system, you've got to think in the end the issue is better for one party than the other. So, in a way, the question is which party is more evenly split. That's the party in the biggest trouble. Or more specifically, I guess you want to look at voters who care so much about this that they might actually
election. It's a question of who wins the election. And I sort of tend to think it depends what the Republicans do in the short term. If the Republicans play to their base and get tough on immigration, I think they do quite well in the congressional elections coming up. Maybe less well in the long term is that's the conventional wisdom, is that they lose Latino votes over the long haul. I'm sort of skeptical of that. But
so you're saying they didn't have enough Latino votes already tucked under their belt to really lose much of that?
Well, no, Bush got a huge chunk of Latino
like
votes.
Like 40% or something.
Yeah, well, that's a lot compared with his share of the black votes, which is yet to reach the double digits, I believe.
Okay, so they do lose Latino votes in the short run. The business community, on the other hand, kind of where are they going to go, right?
Right, exactly.
For Democrats, you would think that the division is between, on the one hand, kind of Latino voters plus a certain number of kind of elite liberals, I think, right, who are ideologically ill-disposed to seem nativist. And then on the other side, you might have working-class whites and blacks.
Well, right, but I just don't think the way to see it is to look at which parties are split.
But in theory,
who gets the most votes?
In theory, the party, if you confine it to voters in each party who are really willing to desert on this issue, then the party who has the most even split among that bloc is in the biggest trouble. Because if you've got an 80-20 split, then you just say sayonara to the 20%. And the other party's got a 50-50%, and they're in 50-50 split. They're in bigger trouble, right? There is an answer to this question, whether we know it or not.
No. I understand. It's just I the standard way to look at midterm congressional election, which may be the same thing that you're saying, is whose voters are most enthusiastic and whose voters are dispirited. And if it seems to me that if the Republicans are the champions of border security, their voters will be enthusiastic. And the Democrats will be sort of all over the lot. So it's a shrewd strategy from the Republican point of view to do that at the congressional level. Now, their problem is that they have a president who's not sending out those signals. But this is Bush's history. This isn't a vote about Bush anymore.
No. So you're saying it actually helps the Republicans?
That's my theory.
Not widely shared, is it? That's not widely said.
That's because I'm a...
You're ahead of the curve.
Or I'm a crazy fringe figure, but the Republicans have been desperately looking for some issue to galvanize their base. Is it going to be, they're going to bring back gay marriage? Are they going to say Christianity's under attack? What's it going to be? And it was traditionally assumed that immigration wasn't that issue because Bush was sort of wishy-washy or centrist or moderate on immigration. But I'm not sure that that's true. It seems to me the Republicans, the Congress, congressional and Senate candidates can distinguish themselves from Bush, and if they want to rally the base, they can rally the base. I think most people think that that theory is wrong. But I've gotten a few emails from people who think it's right.
Well, David Corn stressed the fact that the Republicans, for the time being, are the ones on the playing field, so it's kind of their problem, at least in the short term. You don't think that matters come election time, because in the end it's one candidate against the other, and they both have to declare a position on this issue.
Right, and the media is obsessed with, embarrassing the Republicans on this issue. Republicans split, and they rarely focus on the Democratic split. I mean, we have Paul Krugman leaving the reservation, saying that, well, there are these problems for low-wage workers. We have Byron Dorgan, leaving the reservation and saying, well, I'm not for letting in all sorts of low-wage workers. We have the president of the AFL-CIO saying he doesn't like the guest worker program. So there are big problems for Democrats, yet I don't think you're going to see that many Democratic candidates be able to champion the border control, or however you want to call it, cause. Because they also, they want to embarrass the Republicans on this Latino issue. So they're I don't think, and their base isn't really going to be galvanized by this the way the Republican base is.
Okay. Well, you heard it here first, I think.
I thought I read it a week ago.
Okay, you read it there first. But you heard it here first. I didn't say you read it here first.
No,
you heard it here first.
Okay, cool. There is one interesting issue with immigration that we should discuss, which is this proposed compromise that the Washington Post wrote about in the Senate, where they basically say if you've been here 5 years, you get this semi-amnesty path to citizenship, and if you've been here less than 5 years, we're going to have employer sanctions that basically make it so uncomfortable for you to stay here and find work that you're going to have to leave.
And you dissed that in your blog.
I did not diss that. I reflected an open-minded curiosity about whether this would actually work, because it seems to me the genius of this plan, the problem with the semi-amnesty is not that you let in, you give amnesty to a bunch of people who are already here. That's in itself, that's not a problem. The problem is you send a signal to people who might potentially be illegals in the future that, hey, if you come here, there'll probably be an amnesty for you down the road. It's a huge incentive, a magnet, to attract people. But if you actually also, kick 40% of the people out of the country, and there are TV pictures of these people having to go back to Mexico because they can't find work here, that's a huge disincentive that might count, that might erase the incentive effect of giving a semi-amnesty. So it's possible that this weird compromise might have some merit to it. That's, I think, what I wrote. But chances are that the sanctions won't work. We won't have the demonstration effect of kicking a bunch of people out. And you'll just have the semi-amnesty giving a beacon clarion call saying, come to America and get the next amnesty. But it might work. I mean, if employer sanctions work, maybe that'll be the effect. It's worth exploring, I think.
Okay. Well, I think it's up to me to rein in your obsession with this topic by shepherding us to the next one.
Okay. Your enthusiasm is infectious.
Yeah. Well, no, we argued about the issue itself last time, and I don't know. I don't have any new thoughts.
Okay, it's hot, hot, hot.
Hot, hot, hot. I feel the heat.
Okay. I mean, I have more to say, but...
Well, go ahead.
I mean, everybody's...
I'll just take 40 winks, okay? Go ahead.
Everybody's dumping on Frist for rushing this vote, okay? Because they think he's pandering to the nativist wing of the Republican Party. But rushing the vote actually helps the pro-immigration side, because right now there's a sort of press stampede to who can be, more appealing to the Latino vote, and there are all these demonstrations, and, let's fight the nativists, and so first, a rush vote is probably going to be a more pro-immigrant vote. The backlash hasn't had time to build. And second, Frist is in the perfect position now to sell out the nativists because he's denounced amnesty and he's sort of allied with them. And then if he can embrace a compromise, which he's actively pushing for, say, well, this isn't amnesty, this is okay, and sort of he has more credibility to do that because he's previously allied himself with the anti-immigration side. So it does seem to me that Frist is not, you know, is if you look at it one way, is sort of playing a perhaps inadvertently shrewd pro-immigrant role here. Contrary to what you read in the press.
Well, if it's shrewd and it's Frist, I would think that it's inadvertent.
He just seems so clumsy that, but there may be method in his madness. Or, the answer is I don't know. But you know, it worked out with the judges. Everybody said he's an idiot, he's proposing this nuclear option, but hey, there are two conservative judges on the Supreme Court. It worked pretty well.
That did work out. I'm not sure he envisioned the way it would work out, but for the Republicans,
right,
it worked out.
Yeah. Anyway, okay, I'll move on now.
Okay. That would be to where?
That would be to Iraq, where I'm going to chide you for chiding President Bush for his horrible interference in Iraq's affairs by urging Jafari to step down. And now it looks like, hey, we should have done that months ago. Now Jafari is thinking of stepping down. His own party has issued him a 3-day ultimatum, one day of which has already passed. The general, if you read the blogs this morning, the consensus is pretty bleak, but the consensus is that we should have had this forceful intervention from Bush a few weeks ago. So you were wrong. You were wrong in your reflexive anti-Bushism.
Actually, I said two things. I wondered whether how much leverage Bush has, and it still isn't clear. I mean, Jafari hasn't actually stepped down. Also,
right,
you know, it's less and less clear to me now whether or not Bush going public with his opposition to Jafari was actually intentional, or whether it was a leak by the opposition to Jafari in Iraq, in whom our ambassador had confided Bush's opposition, or what. It's less clear whether it was intentional that Bush go public. In any event, it did seem to have the effect of spurring the Shiite opposition to Jafari to go public.
Right.
That has happened. On the other hand, A, Jafari still hasn't stepped down. B, if he is, if he does step out of the way, it may lead to something actually messier than what we've got now, which is an intra-Shiite split. I mean, one prediction I tentatively will make is that if he steps down, you won't see his previous rival get the spot without Muqtada al-Sadr leaving the Shiite coalition. I think he would have to swallow too much pride to accept the candidate he previously opposed. Remember, Sadr pushed Jafari over the top, and
right,
that's why Jafari was beholden to Sadr. Sadr likes that. I don't think Sadr's going to sit there and let Jafari, A, step down, and B, accept the candidate that Sadr previously opposed. So if that guy stays, you're going to get, I think, a Shiite split. Now the other Shiites can pull it off
terrible
by siding by courting Sunnis and Kurds.
Yeah, why is that such a terrible thing?
Because al-Sadr is a little bit of a hothead, and he has quite a few guns at his disposal. It's just not clear that is a better outcome, and there are people saying that that's even messier. And in any event, there are two questions. I mean, should Bush do what he can to push Jafari out? Sure, fine. I didn't raise that question. The second one is, should he go public about it? I still say that was a mistake. It's not clear that was a prerequisite for having influence. But in any event, that sends a wrong picture to the world. You know, a lot of Muslims already think that we did this war not for democracy, but for some other motivation. Well, this just shores up that belief. B, if al-Sadr does go into opposition, it's a political asset for him that Bush publicly opposed Jafari, because he can style himself as the anti-occupation, the voice of the anti-occupation Shiites, and he will exploit that fact.
Well, look, people are always complaining that the U.S. is interfering in their affairs. The Israelis complain that we're interfering in their affairs when we oppose Sharon. It's a crock when they do it, and it's a crock when the Muslims do it.
Mickey, the question isn't whether it's a crock. It's actually not a crock in either case, but that's not the question
anyway.
We're
allowed to say what we want. If we're giving billions of dollars in aid to the country, we're allowed to say what we want, and we're allowed to withdraw our aid. We're independent actors. That's
Mickey,
what we're allowed
whether
to
whether we're
do.
Allowed to is so far from being the question I'm trying to address here, which is whether it serves our interests. Do you get the distinction
well,
there?
Well, obviously, it was the going public that has put the final pressure on Jafari, so it turned out to be not a crazy thing to do. And the problem was that he didn't have the votes in a democratic system to get the position he wanted. And I if you read Iraq the Mile today, he is fairly pessimistic about the ability to resolve this without some violence with the Sadr forces, who, as you say, are in the process of being marginalized and think they're about to be attacked.
And I repeat, will have been empowered by Bush going public on this, and I'm not the only one who said this. This was pretty much implied by an expert they had on PBS NewsHour last night.
No, I'm not saying that Sadr probably has been slightly empowered, but it's not as if the people who are going to take over the Shiite coalition are pro-American. They're very anti-American, too, so... Sadr has his people, and you know, if he's backed himself into a corner where he doesn't have his Sunni allies, he doesn't have any Shiite allies, he just has his Mahdi army, might not be such a terrible
Sadr
situation.
Sadr is a guy it's probably not in your interest to back into a corner, I'm not sure. But in any event, the one thing this shows, you know, one thing you're hearing now is, well, this split among the Shiites has deep and historic roots. You know, people who know say that. It's just an example of another thing that I think the administration was oblivious to. I was oblivious to going in. It's just another testament to how little of the information we really needed that we actually had when we started this war. We were just kind of woefully underinformed, and that probably should have made us a little more humble.
But it's not necessarily a bad thing that the Shiites just split. The previous worry was that the unified Shiites were going to beat up on the Sunnis.
Well, it's conceivable that kind of civil war, you know, some Shiites plus some Sunnis against some Shiites plus some Sunnis would be less likely to go regional. I don't know, but we're so far, at this point, you know, we're so far into the realm of the unknown. But, you know, one other example of how little the decreasing leverage of the Bush administration there is, you know, we've been trying to get the Interior Ministry to rein in the militias. Well, not only has it not done that, there's a piece in The Guardian within the last couple of days, I'll link to it, saying that the Interior Ministry for the last 2 or 3 months has been refusing to deploy the police that we have been training. You know, all those police who are going to be the salvation because they weren't sectarian and they were well-trained. The Interior Ministry is apparently saying, sorry, we're just not going to suit them up. So,
well,
the thing is sliding beyond the coherent influence of the Bush administration.
That might be at our behest. I mean, there's an interesting piece by, I don't know how to pronounce his name, Roel Marc Gerecht,
yeah,
in the Wall Street Journal about how the Iraqification policy has been a disaster because we've basically armed a bunch of Shiite sectarians who are then going to engage in revenge killings. Our horse there is the army, not the police. So if the Interior Ministry refuses to field the police, that might be a sensible second thought on behalf of our leaders who don't want the police running around killing a bunch of Sunnis and would rather have the army take care of it.
We have put a lot of resources into training the police they're refusing to field.
I thought they wanted more arms so they could go out and kill some more Sunnis.
Well, they may want the arms, but they don't want these particular people who have been holed up in American training camps for, you know.
Yeah. Okay.
They want their own folks out there, and they've got them, I guess. So anyway, I don't know. Are you less optimistic?
I'm not less optimistic. I wasn't very optimistic to begin with. It does seem to me the one thing we've learned is that these sectarian fissures are very deep, and the idea that if only we had done the Iraq war right, which is what the position a lot of people are taking, that it all would have worked out, is sort of a fiction. A convenient fiction for people who were for the war to say, well, I was for the war and I was right to be for the war, but that darn Bush just screwed it up. Obviously, these are things, as John Burns has said, that would have happened with the war regardless of how well it was carried out. It's just a question of whether the sectarian fissures are so strong that they can't be overcome.
I would concede. I thought the war was a mistake from the beginning. Even
right.
I would concede that we'll never know whether it could have worked out better, because certainly things would be different if the Bush administration had done a lot of things differently. But I agree. I mean, the neocon line, that it kind of definitely would have worked if not for Don Rumsfeld or something, is a little too simple. And it seems more and more simplistic the more we learn about the history of some of these divisions, not just between the sects, but within the sects.
Hmm. But there's some divisions that work to our advantage. The division between the Iranian Shiites and the Iraqi Shiites is a good thing, because it means that Ayatollah Sistani is resisting completely becoming a pawn of Iran, and that also there's much more willingness to undertake democracy among the Iraqis than exists in Iran. So anyway, Josh Marshall's analogy of there was this, all these fissures, and they were going to spring open like a steel trap once you took the lid off, is probably the accurate one, and that was going to happen whatever, as long as we toppled Saddam, that was going to happen whether or not we disbanded the army or did all the things, or made all the mistakes that we allegedly made.
We'll never know. And that's my final word on the subject.
Cool. Until the next time. The next topic is... I forgot to ring the bell. Damn it. Okay. The next topic is objectivity and subjectivity in journalism. This is actually a pretty tired subject. Kinsley wrote a very good piece in Slate on it, where he sort of made the case that I've always agreed with, which is subjective journalism where you can't lie about the facts, but you have to defend a point of view, is actually more informative than objective journalism, where you have to hide your beliefs and therefore don't have to defend them. The trouble is, of course, you wonder in a purely subjective sort of internet-type world, who will report on the baseball scores?
That's my great concern.
How will you find out whether... No, but I mean, who will report on objective facts? In other words... either UCLA either did or didn't win last night. There's no subjective way to make it seem like they won. Osama bin Laden either is or isn't dead. You want reporters who will go find that out.
Well, right, but there have been whole systems, like the British system of media, where I gather the media, the periodicals, were fundamentally partisan, and yet they reported on facts, and there was a certain range within which you could trust the facts, right? And I gathered that in an earlier time in American history, newspapers were partisan, right?
Yeah, but apparently that's not the case in Britain now. Apparently, there are a few newspapers that are trustworthy, but most of them actually aren't, because they don't care about the facts. They just care about pleasing their readers. We had a British editor sat in on a Slate meeting just the other day, who said, "Look, this idea that you can trust British newspapers is BS. There are a couple like the Financial Times." And maybe the Guardian that you can trust. But aside from that, it's Katie bar the door. And their standards just aren't up to American standards, apparently, in terms of, like, actually being faithful to the facts. I don't think American standards are all that high, so that's a pretty poor commentary if it's true.
Well, there are actually two separate questions here. I mean, Kinsley cast his piece as kind of wither the newspaper if objective reporting is dead, but there's a second wither the newspaper question, and the two are related, and one is... Leaving aside objectivity versus subjectivity, is it possible that with the reporting of news could become a kind of ad hoc, virtual, in other words, for any given story, a kind of, you see the kind of spontaneous assembly of a chain of information that gets the facts to you. So, for example, people are out at one of these immigration rallies in L.A., and various people are... taking pictures of it with their cell phones, and they're uploading them to their little personal websites, and anyone can link to them, and so bloggers become aware of them, and you choose to link to the ones where you can see a bunch of Mexican flags, and a blogger of a different persuasion might not, and that's where the ideology enters. But there is separately the question of whether the facts cannot get to the blogs. in this kind of ad hoc way. And, you know, some people would be doing little diary-like entries about what they see and so on.
That's a pretty good example. I mean, it seems to me that if you read the L.A. Times coverage of that march and then you read the blog coverage, you got a lot closer to the truth with the blog coverage. The L.A. Times suppressed the fact that there were any Mexican flags there at all. Bloggers went back and forth as to how many there were, and there were photographs. You could count the Mexican flags in the photographs, and you know there were some photographs that were photographs of basically the whole crowd. It's hard to be selective, and eventually you sort of came to an assessment that yeah, there were a lot of Mexican flags there. There were also a lot of American flags, and that's a much clearer picture of what actually was going on than if you just read the L.A. Times, which was totally PC.
Well,
also a monopoly. Also, you know, there's only one of it.
It seems to me that to the extent that this kind of ad hoc news gathering process becomes viable, and it'll become viable as more and more people have camera phones and video, you know, camera phones, increasingly it'll be the case that, like, what are the chances that some actual credentialed journalist gets to the scene of anything before just citizens who have the capability to video stuff and upload it?
Well,
and so that's going to become more and more viable. And actually, if micropayments ever catch on the web, and we're waiting, then there will be an incentive for people like this to go in and interview, the parties involved in the news. And so, anyway, to the extent that all of that becomes more practical, then it does seem to me that the de-objectification of the news is more likely. Because in that world, I think what people do is they turn to their favorite bloggers, and their bloggers lead them to these grassroots, you know, freelance, amateur, quasi-amateur reporters of the bloggers' choosing.
Right. There are a couple of problems. First, you know, only so many people can interview Bill Frist. So, although Instapundit, I think, is one of them. But, that universe is going to be fairly limited. So you're always going to need people who can do that good interview. Maybe some of them will be bloggers, but it'll be a finite sort of select group.
That doesn't matter, because people like Bill Frist, all they say is what they want to say anyway. They might as well never show up in public and just put out press releases.
Well,
that's what they do when they show up on PBS NewsHour.
That tends to be true, although there are probably some people who can worm interesting things out of Bill Frist, and Maureen Dowd is probably one of them.
Occasionally, but there are a whole other genres of news where there isn't that kind of monopoly on the information that the supplier.
The other big problem is investigative journalism, which is very expensive. You spend 6 months on a story and it falls through, and somebody's got to, you have to eat while you're doing that. And my friend Annie Bardak's idea, which I think is a good one, is have universities fund that. The newspapers aren't going to be able to afford to do it. They're already cutting back, and they're going to go. In this model, they get put out of business by the internet anyway. Somebody's got to fund that. We want somebody to fund that. The logical people to do that are universities.
But it could also be that the need for top-down investigative journalism declines as more and more, you know, whistleblowers and casual witnesses are empowered to get the facts they gather out there right away.
It's possible.
Maybe
it's a real
spontaneous investigative reporting or something.
Investigative reporting, though, I can't do it. It's a real skill. So.
But I'm saying that the part of the skill lies in unearthing these sources in whose interest it is to talk once they're unearthed. I'm saying they may be self-unearthing in the future for technological reasons, but that's as far as I want.
That's possible. Usually you have to suck up to them and betray them, though.
Oh.
That's a long process.
Okay.
John McCain?
John McCain. There was this there's this video of McCain on Meet the Press that's on Crooks and Liars. Kevin Drum linked to it and opined, that at least implicitly, that it doesn't reflect well on, or McCain didn't come off looking very good. And secondly, Drum opined that this whole business of McCain as this fierce independent spirit has always been overblown. He's just another conservative. Did you watch the?
I watched the interview. I completely disagree with Kevin. First, I thought
you didn't think he came off well, did you?
Yeah, I thought he came off fine.
I thought he looked incredibly defensive and petulant.
No, I thought he looked. I thought he looked. given the ferocity of Tim Russert's, you know, attack on him, it was...
It was by virtue of the way Tim Russert came off.
The bullishness, McCain kept his calm. The Republican base to which he's appealing isn't going to be annoyed that he kept his calm in the face of Russert.
I wouldn't say he kept his calm. There was an edge in his voice throughout. I mean, he didn't strangle him. He didn't kill him.
He's not used to Tim Russert being anything other than fawning to him, but I just didn't detect that. I bet he can get a lot more petulant than that. The second thing is there's so much time. I mean, this idea that now he's revealed as not a maverick. Well, they were saying I keep remembering after the South Carolina primary in 2000, they were saying, well, Bush, he's so far to the right now, he doesn't have time to get back to the center to win the election, he's screwed. That was completely insane. There wasn't one lifetime. There were 20 lifetimes before the general election. He had plenty of time to get back. What I call the filer faster thesis, the idea that politics move faster, means that there's much more time week to week than we used to think there was. So there's so much time for McCain to appeal to the base and then, you know, reassert his maverick credentials by the general election.
I think Kevin Drum's argument was that his maverickness has just always been just overstated as a repertorial matter.
Well, it's hard to. I mean, he's stuck this torture thing up Bush's craw. He's totally maverick on immigration. Even like sort of against his own interests, maverick on immigration. The campaign finance reform he championed is anathema to large parts of the Republican Party. I don't see how you can argue that he's not genuinely a maverick.
Why do you think journalists so easily fall under his spell? I have a theory.
Because journalists are sucker for candor or seeming candor, and he seems to be candid.
I think there's that. I also think the fact that this generation of journalists, which would include me, are by and large people who didn't go to war. And they're kind of in awe of somebody who, A, went to war, and B, was kind of a hero, you know, withstood torture stoically and so on. I think that's part of McCain's charisma.
Sure, that's part of it. But the main thing is the idea that he seems to actually be saying what he thinks, and even if you disagree with it, you respect him for that. He seems, unlike Frist, he does not seem to be, taking a phony line. I mean, Frist is so inept that even when he's sincere, he makes it seem like he's taking a phony line. And you're right that the Russert interview seemed more phony, but people are willing to... I don't think that does him any long-term
damage.
People
should go watch it. He just looked extremely defensive to me and really put out in a way that he usually doesn't.
We'll link to it and our viewers can decide for themselves. I thought he was placid in an almost Buddha-like way. So...
Yeah.
The truth may lie somewhere in between.
Maybe, and maybe I'm right and you're wrong.
There's always that slim possibility.
Yeah.
Okay.
China.
China. You had some point to make.
Yeah, just kind of a little thing. I guess I have a prediction, actually, about China. Some time ago, I don't know when exactly, two senators, Lindsey Graham and Chuck Schumer, sponsored a bill that would slap a hefty tariff on China in retaliation for its refusal to let its currency appreciate against the dollar, mm-hmm. which, of course, would itself have the effect of reducing American imports of Chinese goods. Then these two senators went over to China a week or so ago and came back and said that they had put this so-called nuclear option on the shelf for the time being. And the sense that people got was that China had the Chinese leaders had reassured them, okay, under this kind of threat, we will do something. Trust us in the coming months that we will let our currency appreciate. And the idea was that the nuclear option had worked. I predict, and I base this on this New York Times piece that I'll talk about. I predict that actually the Chinese currency will appreciate over the next year appreciably, but that it will become increasingly clear that it didn't have anything to do with this nuclear option. And the reason for that is this New York Times piece a couple days ago about how in China, wages are getting bid up, workers are scarce. Increasingly, you're seeing the development of a Chinese middle class. A lot of it's very good news. But one thing it means is that you can expect inflationary pressures to be building up in China, and the way China will naturally export its inflation is to let its currency appreciate. So I think that what's happening is we're just entering a phase where China more and more will see the appreciation of its currency as being in its interest to help its economy cool down a little, to make its good, you know, to actually, you know, keep its exports from rising so fast that they continue to bid up wages and so on.
And the lesson we should draw from that is the traditional Bob Wright lesson that the United States should never attempt to throw its weight around anywhere because it's always counterproductive and it never has a good effect.
Actually, that's not what I was planning to say, but and I'm not sure I'd be willing to, because it really wasn't the U.S. I mean, it wasn't the executive branch that was throwing its weight around.
Well, presumably the executive branch was happy that Schumer and Graham were out there making their noises.
It wouldn't have bothered me if the threat had worked as a threat, but if they had delivered, it would have bothered me. I would be against the tariffs, absolutely, and there is a question of how credibly you can use a threat if you're not going to deploy it. So
right.
If the idea was to actually deploy the threat, I'd be against that. The moral I would like to draw is that basically the free traders are turning out to be right in a way sooner than I thought even in that, although yes, in the short term you definitely... there are definitely American workers who are hurt by free trade, no doubt about it. But in the long run, and now it's looking like in the medium run, one thing you see is that a middle class starts to develop in China. They will be importing things from other countries. And moreover, as their wages rise, they become less of a competitive threat to American workers. Now, of course, what happens next is the factories move to Vietnam and India and places that will have relatively low wages. And I admit that it takes a long time before the entire world's wages get bid up.
But it's happening a lot faster than we thought.
In China, I had not expected to see this story this soon. And the data, although kind of consistently anecdotal, I thought was convincing.
Yeah, no, I agree. That was a very, very important and amazing story, that they're running out of workers in China. I guess if you have a one-child policy, eventually that catches up to you.
Now, that's another very interesting thing that came out is that's one thing that's happening is that the one-child policy is a little over a couple decades old, I think. So all these only children are just kind of leaving college, entering the workforce, and it's interesting to see what's going to happen now because one thing about them is that they are very heavily invested in by their parents. So they're very well educated by and large.
Right.
They're not interested in doing menial work for low wages,
right.
And it'll be interesting to see what the effects of that are. In a way, you can imagine China in 10 or 20 years kind of being like the U.S., except without the working class, almost. I mean, having...
No, I think that ultimately the threat from China is not that they will outproduce us on the factory floor, but they will outthink us in the universities, and they're going to produce so many brilliant people that their colleges will be better than our colleges.
Yeah, well... they will be producing a lot of, what did Robert Reich used to call them, symbolic analysts?
He stupidly called them symbolic analysts when they're really symbol analysts, yes. But Bob, you can't, all that's true, but it's still true that the effect of trade is to make wages very low for unskilled American workers. In order to make a good middle-class income in America now, you need skills, which means the income is stratified by education and smarts, which means it has sort of a more evil, insidious cast than it did before, when you could be unskilled, go to work for Detroit, and make $50,000, $60,000, $70,000. So trade has had I'm for free trade, but it definitely is not. It's not like it doesn't have pernicious effects. Even if we prosper, it has those pernicious effects because people who are unskilled and not smart don't make a lot of money in a free trade regime.
I think that's true. I mean, there's no doubt that in the short run, American workers sometimes find themselves in a zero-sum game with foreign workers. But aren't you kind of surprised that given how much cheap labor has suddenly come online in the global economy, that the effects haven't been worse in America in a way? I mean, I guess, income inequality, what, is slightly growing now? But the unemployment rate is not very high.
No, right. And I guess the lesson there is that there's still enough jobs that have to be performed in America that the low-wage market can be tight, which is why it seems to me we have to prevent it from being swamped by immigrants. But yes, the conventional wisdom is that income inequality is still growing, but only at the top. In other words, during the 90s, the whole income structure was pulled apart. I get this from Gary Berkles, who's a smart labor economist at Brookings. The whole income structure was pulled apart. Middle-class workers made more than lower-wage workers. But that sort of stopped at the end of the Clinton era, and now it's just that the rich are getting richer.
So you're saying, A, workers in, say, the 30th percentile of income, A, they're not losing income in real terms, their wages aren't dropping in real terms, and B, they're not falling relative to, say, workers in the 70th percentile income percentile?
I think that's right. I think that I may be wrong, and maybe I'll have to correct this, but I think that the bottom 90% of the income is basically frozen static, not doing anything.
Well, in any event,
the top is exploding.
I also think, I mean, you know, if you think long term about the problem of terrorism, you know, the goal does have to be in the long term that you bring kind of the whole world online, and that's one reason we can't really retreat from free trade, although I would like to see more trade directed, you know, to the areas that are the likely trouble spots in that regard, like the Arab world and Africa.
I thought you were going to say this is a vindication for the Bob Wright worldview because it shows that labor standards worldwide can rise fairly quickly. So that there's you know.
Well, it's actually the article did note that some companies are increasing benefits, not just wages.
Right.
But I have never been opposed. There's two things I've never been opposed to. One is using the World Trade Organization to lift labor standards upward. Although I would want to start fairly humbly with goals like guaranteeing the right to bargain collectively everywhere. B, I've never been opposed to these kind of non-governmental forms of regulation where NGOs certify goods as coming from factories that, you know, have working
right.
bathrooms and stuff. I those two things are fine with me. And
right, okay. So, yeah. So you're not just for letting the market work. You're for...
No. I just think increasingly that regulation, to be effective, will need to move beyond the national level to the regional or global level.
Right. Okay, if we have any viewers left after a discussion of international trade and...
it's been a pretty sober
currency,
dialogue.
Currency fluctuations. That's always a crowd pleaser. So...
It's what pushes my buttons. Well, so we're going to do viewer email now?
Yeah, and I haven't read it, so you're going to, I think...
Kate?
Propose...
First of all, okay, a couple, and then... okay, first of all... Paul I. from San Antonio, where I went to high school, heard me assert, without foundation, that if we could police the borders with the troops in Iraq, you know, that you could line them up and they'd be able to see each other all the way along the 2,000 miles. He actually did the math, assuming 40-hour work week, so you'd have three shifts per day, 2 weeks vacation. I mean, he did the math and concluded that I was actually correct. They'd be about 100 yards apart. Thank you, Paul. Now, Mickey, Nick writes with this question, do you and Robert Wright actually like each other at all? At times I get the impression that one or the other of you would like to reach through your camera and strangle the other. If you two are friends, you don't seem like it, at least as far as I can tell. Mickey?
Well, I was kind of annoyed with you this morning, but I think... I don't think it's a deal breaker. So,
he's on to something here.
No, basically, it's you that want to strangle me. I maintain a pacific calm throughout.
Now, this gets to the next thing that he said, Mickey, which is really what got my goat. Has Mr. Wright been channeling Mr. Spock? Does he have emotions at all?
Everybody thinks you have no emotions. They're just not detecting the subtle irony and the subtle signals.
Especially, I continue reading, especially positive emotions such as joy or warmth. Are his facial muscles capable of smiling? Now, Mickey, the idea that I would be less evidently warm than you, I mean, I don't notice a lot of warmth bubbling up from your soul, right?
Well, I'm not as, you're just heavily into this postmodern ironic mode. Formerly the laconic cowboy mode, where
there,
you don't.
Now you're getting my cultural roots. It's from West Texas.
You don't wear your heart on your sleeve, and I do claim that I have a little more, a little more old school schmaltz. But
I have been more vividly emotional than you have.
That's true, but
on occasion,
not in a positive
in terms
way.
Of the extremes reach.
But not in a positive
I have
way.
Come close to actually cracking on the air.
Anyway, don't we want to get to the mottos?
Oh, the mottos.
Okay.
This is the motto contest.
We've asked our readers to submit mottos for Blogging Heads TV.
Mugs and T-shirts and things.
Yeah.
Aaron S. suggests, blah, blah, Blogging Heads. Aaron, I'm afraid that one's not going anywhere. David Z., in a world at loggerheads, watch Blogging Heads TV.
Ooh.
I like the sentiment. It's a little wordy.
Close, but yeah, no, that is the right spirit.
Yeah, okay.
We're bringing America together. We have Byron York and David Corn.
Right.
And they're talking to each other.
Right.
It's so moving.
And I'll get back to that theme of bringing the world together later and as we go through more of these. Nathan B., Blogging Heads TV, die of vlogging a dead moose. Like vlogging a dead moose, like vlogging a... You like it?
No, I admire the spirit. I don't think it quite works, but...
I admire the spirit, too. Bob M.
Just too complicated.
Blogging Heads TV, asymptotically approaching clarity. I like the idea.
No, I like that idea, too. Because it's always been my theory that...
Now tell me if I should write any of these down as finalists. Have you heard anything that merits that yet?
Not quite.
David H., heads will blog. I mean, in general, that we probably shouldn't have blogging heads in there because it's going to say Blogging Heads TV and then say something else, and you'd probably
right.
like to, not to be too phonetically redundant there.
Right. Right.
I wish I could quit you. You know... I like the idea of people getting addicted to the site.
Right.
Jake W. writes in, Diavlog killed the written blog star, you know, a reference to...
Yeah. Video killed the radio star.
Right.
Like the spirit, but I don't think it's going to kill the written blog
Paul
star.
Paul W. suggests we give great blogging heads. Paul, it's a family show. It's a family show.
Yeah.
But Paul also suggests... And this, I take, is really a variation on Diavlog Me. And I think if this won, we would give credit to the originator, the submitter of Diavlog Me. Diavlog Bat! Exclamation point. Again, you have a rhythmic parallel with a known phrase. You know what that phrase is, Mickey? Movie title? Analyze that. Diavlog that.
Except it's called Analyze This.
Is it?
I think. But anyway... Diavlog.
There were actually two, I think. I think there was a sequel, maybe.
Diavlog Me is looking better and better in retrospect.
You like it better than Diavlog That or Diavlog
This?
Yes,
because it has the sexual component.
Yeah, but I'm wondering how many people are going to want to wear that T-shirt for that very reason. I mean, you can imagine, you know...
You underestimate the coarsening of American culture. Of course they're going to wear that.
But we're against the coarsening of American culture.
People wear T-shirts to say FCUK. So they're going to...
I'm against that.
Diavlog Me is nothing.
No, I will not abet the coarsening of American culture.
That's the new clean.
I like
dirty is the new clean.
But anyway, here's one that inspired me. First of all, this guy, John M., says, I'm going to assume that since at least one of you is a free marketer, you are incentivizing my efforts, free shirt or mug, if you use my motto. I think John M. has got us mixed up with somebody else, Mickey.
Although
I was thinking maybe you could, a free autographed copy of your book, The End of Equality, wouldn't be a bad prize for the ultimate winner.
Surely if we sell t-shirts, we can give the winner a t-shirt, yes.
Nah, I like the yearbook idea. But anyway, John M. proposes making politics interesting one dialogue at a time, which spurred this thought in me, saving the world one dialogue at a time. Now, you probably won't like that.
I don't mind. It fits in with your megalomaniacal messianic complex.
Precisely.
So you
are indifferent to the fate of humanity. So I was pretty sure you wouldn't like saving the world one dialogue at a time, but I'm writing it down.
I have one foot in Jim Pickett's spaceship.
Yeah.
He's indifferent because he's got a plan
B. There are going to be about three people who fit in that.
My theory is that, first we're going to build all these spaceships to escape Earth, and then we're going to, fill the first one with the Bin Laden family, and then there's not going to be any room for the rest of us, but...
Wow.
It's a joke. Never mind. Okay.
So look, I'm afraid we've come to the end. We didn't read nearly all of them. I mean, a lot came in. That was at most...
That was the cream of the crop?
I am personally... Remember, it's time to deploy the moose.
That's okay.
You like that. I like saving the world one dialogue at a time.
And dialogue, right?
You say me, not that?
Yes.
Well, so for the time being, should we...
Dialogue me, you blogging head, you.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think at this point maybe we should take the discussion offline, Mickey.
God, you're such a prude.
I am. I've got kids.
It's like you have daughters or something.
I know. So those three, and I think we can in principle make all three available, right?
Well, those would certainly be the winners. I think we should hold out for at least another tranche of submissions, because we got a lot last time. It was a very good response.
Yeah, but at some point, we got to pull the trigger here.
But that point is not now.
You don't think so?
I don't think so. I think we can milk it for one more thing.
Okay.
Okay,
but I would say make sure they're good.
Yes.
That's my advice to submitters.
Yes.
Because there's a lot of paperwork we're talking about. Right now, though, the semifinalists are, it's time to deploy the moose, saving the world one dialogue at a time, and dialoguing.
Correct.
Okay. Well, I'm glad we got that taken care of.
We're incredibly efficient.
That's us.
Okay. So I will see you next time.
All right.
Okay.
Bye.
See ya.